says to the crowds who are gathered in front of him, listen to what they say. Obey and do what the scriptures that they read call for you to do. But, he says, don't do what they do. Why? Because they don't practice what they preach. Their primary concern is not honoring what the scriptures say, but instead how they look, and especially how they look to other people. Everything they do is done for men to see, Jesus says. Their primary concern is not what God says or thinks, but what other people say and think about them. What's most important to them is that other people see them and treat them as important. Jesus says this to the crowds because there's a danger here. When our primary concern in life becomes what others see, say, and think about us, when our image and our position in life becomes the most important, we run the risk of getting a big head. We run the risk of thinking of ourselves more highly than we ought. And as our heads get bigger, our hearts suffer and get smaller. As we become more concerned about how we appear on the outside, our hearts begin to pay the price on the inside. Therefore, Jesus says to the religious leaders of the day and to us who are here this morning, watch out. Woe to you, Jesus says. Woe to you who are worried about how you look on the outside. Look instead on the inside, Jesus says. If you desire to be clean and to be presentable on the outside, Jesus reminds them to examine and clean the inside of the cup, their heart. Examine your heart, Jesus says. If your heart is clean, then your outside will be clean as well. If you desire to be exalted, Jesus says, humble yourself.
The second symptom this morning is found in Hebrews chapter 3. See to it, brothers and sisters, that none of you has a sinful, unbelieving heart that turns away from the living God. But encourage one another daily, as long as it is called today, so that none of you may be hardened by sin's deceitfulness. Notice in these verses that the danger, day in and day out, is that a sinful, unbelieving heart would lead us away from God. Sin and unbelief are the issues here. When we choose to disobey what God commands, when we choose to instead go our own way, when we turn away from God, then our hearts turn away from God as well. When we don't believe in God's promises, when we don't believe that obedience to God will bring us blessing, then our hearts turn away from the living God. You may say, when I choose to disobey God, I don't choose to disobey God. I don't choose to be impatient with my kids. They just drive me nuts at the end of the day. I don't choose to cheat on my taxes. The government has just made it way too confusing, and they're probably wrong about a couple of things. I don't choose to lust after my coworker. It's just that he's so much more thrilling than my own spouse is.
Easy. Easy, good. Easy.
So we don't choose to laugh at those things. We don't choose to say that, yes, you know, I'm choosing to sin against God. But the commands in this passage say it differently. When it says, see to it that none of you has a sinful, unbelieving heart, and when it says, encourage one another daily, those are commands that show that faithfulness is a conscious choice. The NIV commentary on this passage says, we cultivate faithfulness by listening to God's voice and choosing life patterns of obedience. We cultivate faithfulness by listening to God's voice and choosing life patterns of obedience. Over and over again, the author of Hebrews makes it clear that belief in God is a combination of faith and obedience. So when we choose to not obey, the effect is that our hearts become hardened toward God. Sin tricks us into thinking that it won't matter. One little tiny sin, that's not going to make that big of a difference. But sin is deceitful. Choosing to sin turns our hearts away from the living God.
The third symptom is idolatry. Listen to the last verse, the last few words of 1 John. John ends his letter with these words. He says, "Dear children, keep yourself from idols." He ends his letter, "Keep yourself from idols." Why do you think that John ends his letter this way? Why does he end with this four-word phrase? John ends his letter with these words because he knows the powerful effects idols have on our hearts. When you hear the word idol, what comes to your mind? American Idol. All right, there you go. Anybody else? What comes to your mind? How would you define or explain to someone what an idol is? Idol. What comes to your mind? Yeah, go ahead. Something highly revered by culture. Okay. Go ahead, Jerry. Oh, okay. An Indiana Jones figure. A little gold figure. All right. Very nice. Okay. How would you know if... somebody said something? A shrine. Okay. How would you know if you had an idol? How would you know if you had one in your life? Okay. All right. Don Cousins defines an idol this way. He says, "It's anything that we have in addition to Jesus in order to be happy." So anything that we have that we need to be happy in addition to Jesus becomes an idol. Idols, the Apostle Paul says in Romans 1, are the created things that we worship and that we serve instead of our Creator. Paul says this of humanity in verses 21 through 22 through 25 in Romans 1. He says, "Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles. They exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served created things rather than the Creator." Idols are the things we worship and serve in our lives in order to help us find and secure peace within our hearts. Tim Keller, in talking about idolatry in a postmodern age, says this. He says, "Individually, we will ultimately look either to God or to success, romance, family, status, popularity, beauty, or something else to make us feel personally significant and secure and to guide our choices. Culturally, we will ultimately look either to God or to the free market, to the state, to the elites, to the will of people, to science and technology, military might, human reason, racial pride, or something else to make us corporately significant and secure and to guide our choices." The problem, however, with our idols is that you and I will never find peace for our hearts through them. Only when our hearts rest in God, our Creator, will you and I find peace. Only when you and I have undivided hearts, only when we seek to worship and serve God, will we find significance and the security that we are looking for and that our hearts long for. Therefore, John writes these words. He says, "Keep yourselves from idols. Guard your hearts against them. Ask yourself, is there anything that I have in addition to Jesus in order to be happy? Am I lifting my soul to another thing? If so," John says, "get rid of it. Keep yourself from it." We're going to spend the next few moments singing a song together. The song is entitled, "Give Us Clean Hands." And as we sing, I invite you to reflect on the lyrics, which is a prayer of confession. Use this time to reflect on these three symptoms. We sang that song, "Open up the eyes of my heart, Lord." I invite you to use this time to allow your heart to be opened up to God. Allow His Spirit to speak to you this morning. It's all done in vain. Have you ever done something when your heart wasn't in it? Do you know about the difference that Jesus is talking about here? Today's Valentine's Day, right? It's the day that we recognize the people that we love. And each year, men, we have a choice. Right? We can go through the motions of Valentine's and we can get a card, get some chocolates, hand it to her. Happy Valentine's Day. Okay? Or we can put our hearts into it. Do you know the difference between the two? Do you think our girlfriends and our spouses know the difference between the two? I know Amy put their heart into it this year because what was waiting for me on Friday morning? Krispy Kreme donuts. A dozen of them. Raspberry-filled Krispy Kreme donuts. Amy went out of her way, right, way out of the southeast side of town, stopped at Krispy Kreme and says, "I love you." She put her heart into it. Why? How do I know this? Because Pastor Henry loves Krispy Kreme donuts. I love them. Right? She could have just given me a card, "Happy Valentine's Day," but no, she said, "I knew she put her heart into it." I'm coaching Henry John's third grade basketball team right now. I don't know if any of you have ever coached third graders before, but that's a challenge in and of itself, all another story. It's like herding cats, yeah. It's interesting. But we do drills, different drills to increase their skills. And if you watch those third graders, there's some boys who are just kind of going through the motions. Dribbling around the cone, dun 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 dun. Right? But then there's other boys that are doing it with their heart into it. They're focused. They're low. Right? They got that ball. They're watching. They're throwing good passes. They're not just like doing this or what da da da. Do you know the difference of doing something, just kind of going through the motions, or putting your heart into it? Friends, how is your desire to worship today? Are you eager? Are you motivated? Are you passionate about worshiping God? Or do you feel like you're just going through the motions? Do you feel like you're far away? Do you feel like you're close right now? If you're feeling dry and far away, like you're just going through the motions, Jesus says, look at your heart. Examine your heart. Something might not be right there.
Then Jesus told his disciples a parable to show them that they should always pray and never give up. He said, "In a certain town there was a judge who neither feared God nor cared about men. And there was a widow in that town who kept coming to him with the plea, 'Grant me justice against my adversary.' For some time he refused. But finally he said to himself, 'Even though I don't fear God or care about men, yet because this widow keeps bothering me, I will see that she gets justice so that she won't eventually wear me out with her coming.' And the Lord said, 'Listen to what the unjust judge says. And will not God bring about justice for his chosen ones who cry out to him day and night? Will he keep putting them off? I tell you, he will see that they get justice, and quickly. However, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on earth?'" Usually Jesus tells these stories called parables, and they leave the listener wondering to exactly what he's talking about. In fact, often after he would tell these stories to a large crowd, he would bring his disciples, his closest friends, off to the side, and they would say, "Explain that to us. What did it mean?" And then Jesus very clearly, very simply, would have to say, "This is what the story means." But this parable starts out differently. In this parable, Jesus right away from the very beginning says, "Then Jesus told his disciples a parable to show them that they should always pray and never give up." And then there are two characters in the story that follows. The first is a judge, whom Jesus calls unjust. In the court system of that day, the widows and the orphans were to take priority over any other matter. If there was a widow or an orphan who needed justice, who needed the help of a judge, he was to drop everything else and to take care of that first. But that's not what is happening here. The judge persistently ignores the widow's request. The widow, the second character in the story, keeps persisting and keeps seeking justice. Even though she's continually being ignored, she's persistent in her request. Well, in the end, this parable is actually more about the widow than it is about the judge. No matter what type of person this judge is, if he's somebody that cares about God or cares about men, if it's somebody who's just or unjust, the widow, Jesus says, is right in her persistence. The story is really about her. It's about her faith. It's about her trust that in the end, justice would be served. Scott Jose wrote some notes on this passage that I couldn't pass up, and I'd like to share them with you. He says, "This passage makes clear that in the end, it's not about whether or to what extent or what in what manner God will rain down justice on earth. It's not about whether God wants to do that, or even about whether or not there are seasons for some reason that God seems to put us off for a while. There are countless unknown variables that go into God's providential maintenance of the world. We cannot see all the ends, and so there are prayers that seem to go unanswered. Not unheeded, perhaps, but unanswered in the sense that of our not receiving what we wanted or what we deemed the best outcome. That kind of disappointment usually leads us to begin wondering what exactly God is up to. What is on God's mind? What kind of God is he, anyways? And it can lead us to become discouraged in prayer, a sign of an unhealthy heart. The story in Luke 18 turns the tables and puts the focus back on us. It puts the focus on our faith. We have to assume the best about our God's goodness, about his love, his justice, and his mercy. And by faith, we hang on to our belief that whether we are washed in answered prayers at any given moment or not, But in the end, we should worry less about the character of God and worry more about the strength and the persistence of our own faith. God may well be good and great and all-loving and all of that, but if people stop praying, how can they ever expect God to display that goodness and that love here on earth? If we are too discouraged to pray, what does that say about the condition of our heart? These have been 12 symptoms of an unhealthy heart over the past 3 weeks. And if you're like Henry and I after we heard these symptoms the first time when we were at that pastoral retreat in the fall, we walked out of there for some free time this afternoon and I was like, I think I'm going to have a heart attack. I don't feel very healthy right now. As I look at that list of 12 symptoms, I'm wondering where I am. How is my heart doing? How do I get it better? In a few minutes, we'll spend some time in confession after the next song. And that's part of the answer. I also want to invite you back to the weeks to come when we talk about those healing possibilities, about how things like forgiveness, about how things like looking at the lies the devil tells us and the truth that God gives us, how those types of things can begin to work in our heart and to heal the conditions of our heart. For now, let's turn to God in worship.